Master Chief Oliver looked at the time. 2 hours to go before the launch. In another hour, his men would leave on a hazardous mission, and he would call in their orders from the safety of a ship. They would face danger, and he would command them from far away. Oliver chided himself for hiding on a ship while his men faced the enemy on otherwise uninhabited moons. He felt humiliated. Replacing Emerson Ilyich as Master Chief of the SEALs was a nightmare for Oliver. Like an undergraduate second stringer replacing an injured varsity athlete, Oliver saw himself as having inherited the promotion instead of earning it. He thought about Ilyich's dying on A361F while he would not go on the mission to A361D, and experienced a stab of the self-loathing that had been hardwired into every SEAL clone's brain. He met with Warren and Harmer in the SEAL training barracks. All three SEALs might have been thinking the same thing, but Warren was the one who voiced it.
I'm sorry you can't come with us.
I wanted to go on the mission.
Everybody knows that. Give us a little credit.
You know, it's not going to be like Ilyich's mission. You saw the files. It's a flat surface. That's all it is. Probably just an abandoned landing strip. I bet the only thing we find is a million-year-old sign that says, "Keep off the grass."
Oliver tried to smile, but he felt so humiliated.
Honestly, the aliens won't even bother coming after us. Not on a moon like that. They probably forgot the place exists.
About a half an hour before launch, Oliver met with Captain Miyamoto in his office. Miyamoto kept the Master Chief standing at attention as he sat behind his desk.
At ease, Master Chief. We have canceled the mission.
Was there a reason, sir?
Admiral Yamashiro canceled the mission. I do not believe the Admiral needs to explain his decision. The Admiral does not wish to risk men for a closer look at ancient artifacts. We lost a dozen men learning about 100,000-year-old ice and empty silos. There is no point throwing away more lives.
Sir, what if the sites have military value?
Military value? Master Chief, did you look at the recon photos? Those sites are of no strategic value except as target practice.
Location, Terrano. Galactic position, Scutum Crux Arm. Astronomic location, Milky Way. Freeman nodded as I entered the room and continued fiddling with his communications computer. The time was 0700 according to the space travel clock. The virtual version of William Sweetwater and Arthur Breeze should have arrived at their virtual lab.
How much can we tell them?
We can tell them about Terrano.
Won't they already know about it?
The only things we can tell them are things they already know.
Well, how much trouble will we cause if we leave the script?
Freeman did not respond.
Are we going to ask them where the aliens are going next?
Freeman nodded.
You do realize that the Unifieds have probably told them that we died on Olympus Cree. They may be surprised to see us.
Only Andropov would have that kind of clearance. Unless they ask, the only thing we will tell them about ourselves is that we are alive.
The screen flashed to life, showing a large laboratory. Sweetwater, who was working near the camera, looked up.
Now here's a surprise.
Are you alone?
At the moment. Raymond, aren't you supposed to be dead?
Not that I know of.
How did he die?
Sweetwater gave the lab a visual sweep, then stepped closer to the camera.
They said you both died on Olympus Cree.
We went to Terrano after Olympus Cree.
We heard about Terrano. What a tragedy. We heard no one survived.
We got 1,000 people off Terrano.
Arthur tracked the Avatari signal to Boda's galaxy. The Navy should have sent a fleet to destroy their home world by now.
They sent the Japanese fleet.
Then I had to grit my teeth to stop from swearing, because below the table, Freeman had dug the heel of his oversized boot into my shin to get my attention. He was right, of course. The launch of the Japanese fleet would have taken place between Sweetwater's death and digital resurrection. I had wandered into dangerous grounds.
Are we correct in assuming that you are no longer working with the Unified Authority?
Not wanting to risk another sub-table attack, I looked at Freeman for cues on how to proceed. He met my gaze and gave me a single nod.
Yes, sir. That would be a correct assumption.
Are you fugitives?
Enemies might be a better description.
I see. We're out of the loop up here on the wheel.
The virtual versions of Sweetwater and Breeze lived on a computer simulation of the Arthur Clarke space station, better known as the Wheel.
I was about to say something, but the dwarf scientist put up a hand and shushed me. Someone had entered the laboratory. Before I could see who, our connection went dead. Unless some four-star survived the ambush at Olympus Cree without telling me, I was the highest-ranking officer in the enlisted man's empire, and I did not consider myself fit for command. I was a combat marine, not an admiral. I wanted to find my successor. All of the two-star and three-star candidates died at Olympus Cree, leaving me with three one-star admirals to choose from. One look at the field, and I already knew that the pickings were slim. Along with being the ranking officer in the meeting, I was the lone marine in attendance. I brought Don Cutter with me as an advisor. Cutter and I were the only people actually sitting in the room. The other officers attended as holographic images sent in via the broadcast network. We sat at one end of a long table, watching the other attendees through a transparent screen that looked for all intents and purposes like a pane of glass.
Have any of you heard from Warshaw?
Somewhere inside me, I still hoped that Warshaw had survived the ambush at Olympus Cree. The arrogant prick strutted like a peacock, and he wasn't worth shit in combat situations. But Warshaw was a great organizer. He created an empire out of chaos. All three of the admirals shook their heads.
No one? Have any of you heard back from your commanding officers?
They gave the same response. That didn't surprise me. All of our top brass had been at Olympus Cree when the Unifieds caught us flat-footed. Looking around the table, I noticed how the three admirals looked similar, but with unique features. They were all clones, all 5'10", with brown hair and brown eyes. Two of them looked to be in their early 30s, the other in his 50s. He had rims of white hair around his ears. He was also fat as a whale.
The Unifieds attacked our ships after we evacuated Olympus Cree. As far as I know, the Churchill is the only ship that escaped.
What about the Kamehameha? Do you think she survived?
The speaker was Rear Admiral Stephen Jolly. I'd never met Jolly in person, but I'd heard stories about him. By reputation, he was a man of unlimited ambition who suffered from depression and self-doubt. Nobody respected Admiral Jolly, not even Jolly himself.
I was on the Kamehameha when the attack started.
Did you see her go down?
The Kamehameha was the first ship they destroyed.
What about Admiral Cloward? He was on the Clinton?
I didn't see the Clinton go down. Admiral Warshaw ordered every ship to the broadcast zone. The Churchill was the closest ship to the zone, and we barely made it through. The last ship I saw was the Salah Ad-Din. She was right behind us, but the Unifieds were closing in on her.
If the Kamehameha went down, all of your commanding officers went with her. They were with Warshaw on the Kamehameha when the attack began.
What were they doing on the Kamehameha?
They were negotiating reunification with the Unifieds. The UA sent an ambassador.
Did Andropov attend?
Martin Traynor came in his place.
Traynor? Who the hell is he?
I knew Leota by reputation, too. He was a weasel. According to Cutter, people called Leota Curtis the Snake behind his back. Leota was an outspoken critic of everyone and everything that did not suit him. He openly criticized other officers' tactics and battle strategies, despite having risen to the rank of Rear Admiral, lower half, without ever seeing combat.
The only thing I know about Traynor is that the Linear Committee sent him. I think he's Secretary of Galactic Expansion or some odd thing.
And they sacrificed him.
He left the ship a few moments before the attack.
The hell you say? No one made it off the Kamehameha.
I did. I saw Traynor leaving the summit and followed him to a landing bay. That's the only reason I made it off the ship. I was already near my shuttle when the attack began.
The silence in the room was so heavy it felt like it was made of bricks. Wallace, the youngest of the one-stars, broke that silence.
It's time we annihilated those speckers once and for all.
Wallace looked fit, but he had a disfigured face. Long, striping scars covered his forehead and cheeks and neck, making his head look like a misshapen map. He might have seen action, or he might have been in a fire. I would not have trusted the surgeon who performed Wallace's skin grafts to wrap a Christmas present.
No, we can't attack Earth.
Why the hell not?
Because it's Earth.
Are you saying that because Earth is the goddamn speckin' home of humanity, we have to let those Unified bastards get away with an ambush? Bullshit, Jolly. That's bullshit, and you know it.
We cooperated with them and they ambushed us. That can't go unanswered. If we let them get away with it, then...
I don't get it. How did they catch us with our pants down? I mean, what was going on?
The specking bastards set us up.
Looks that way.
Oh, what about Olympus Kree? The reason we went there in the first place was to evacuate the planet before the aliens attacked it. Was the whole thing a trick?
It must have been.
The aliens attacked Olympus Kree. They have attacked three planets so far. New Copenhagen, Olympus Kree, and Terrano.
How the hell do we know that's not more unified authority bullshit?
I was on Olympus Kree when they attacked. I was on Terrano as well. The Unifieds don't have anything powerful enough to do what the aliens did to those planets. We'd be having this discussion in the afterlife if they did.
What's the matter with them? Wasn't the alien attack enough?
Nothing will be enough for them. The bastards came under a flag of truce.
I had come to this meeting hoping to find a worthy successor for Warshaw, but the prospects were dim. Jolly was next in line. He had more self-control than the other two, but he came across as weak. I asked myself if I really wanted to place the enlisted man's navy in that man's trembling hands.
Were you able to evacuate Terrano?
No.
I heard they wanted to join the Specking Unified. It sounds to me like those assholes got what they deserved. And who gives a shit about Terrano? I'm glad those Speckers died. The universe is better off without them.
I'm not here to discuss the people of Terrano or their place in the universe. The look Wallace shot me could have set off a fire alarm. His face flushed red. As he glared at me, he clenched his teeth so hard that his chin quivered. The aliens are retaking the planets we liberated from them, and they're not going to stop until they reach Earth. They're following our schedule. First, we beat them on New Copenhagen, so they burned New Copenhagen first. The first planets we rescued were Olympus Kree and Terrano. Does anybody know which planet came next?
There was some head shaking. Obviously, no one knew the answer. It didn't matter. Sweetwater and Breeze would know, assuming they were willing to divulge information to enemies of the state.
It may not have occurred to you, General, but our hands are pretty well tied. I'm here in the Perseus arm. Curtis is in the Cygnus Central. Until we find some method to program our broadcast stations, we're stuck where we are.
He did not mention Admiral Wallace.
You don't have keys?
I should have known. The late Admiral Warshaw only gave the keys to control the broadcast system to his fleet commanders, the guys who died in the ambush.
They weren't exactly standard issue.
Fleet commanders only.
And all of the fleet commanders were on the Kamehameha.
Finishing the statement, I held up a little device for the officers to see. It was the size of a deck of playing cards and a quarter of an inch thick. It was all black, with a touchscreen.
Warshaw gave this to me right before the attack. I needed it to get to Terrano.
Why did he give a shit about Terrano?
If you saw what happened on Olympus Kree, you'd understand.
What exactly happened?
They ignited the atmosphere, lit the planet to 9,000 degrees and let it burn. By the time they got through, every living thing was incinerated.
And you think they're going to do that to all of our planets?
Not if we hit them first.
We can't hit them, Admiral. It's not like they're flying to planets and attacking from ships. They're hitting us from some other galaxy, a billion light years away. We've already lost the war. We're not fighting. We're evacuating refugees.
But we only have one broadcast key.
My engineers can make more.
So we'll have our broadcast network back.
The way I see it, Admiral, we'll be one big happy Navy in a couple of hours. Admiral Jolly, we're going to need a Supreme Commander.
Are you placing me in charge?
Yes, sir.
But you outrank Admiral Jolly.
Rank isn't everything. Have any of you ever heard of the Praetorian Guard?
When they shook their heads, I smiled.
No? Well, maybe it's for the best. They were the troops who guarded the emperors of Rome. Caesar, Caligula, Otho, they guarded all of them.
What's your point?
I'm a Marine. I'm a combat officer, not the kind of man who runs empires. I'm the kind of guy who guards the throne, not the kind who sits in it.
Well done, General. That makes perfect sense.
Leota gave me a casual salute.
But the bastard still has more stars than us.
You can have him if you want. As of this moment, Admiral Jolly, you are in charge.
You've just relinquished your command, General. You no longer have the authority to make that kind of decision.
I still have 3 stars. I turned to Jolly. Unless you plan to strip me of command.
No, General. I think you should hold on to those stars.
Come on.
Ava waited for me in my billet. Fighting the effects of a growing depression, she sat on my rack, watching a movie on a pair of MediaLink shades. When she heard me come in, she tore off the shades.
I was watching your movie.
My movie?
The Battle for Little Man. You don't look a thing like Sean Gregory.
Gregory was the square-jawed male model who played natural-born me.
Really? I thought that was the most accurate part of the movie.
You're much better looking than Sean.
I knew that.
I'm not kidding. You should see Sean in person.
He isn't 6 feet tall and covered with muscles?
Well, he is pretty tall.
And muscular?
He does have big arms and that chest.
It felt nice to flirt with Ava, even though I could tell she was putting on an act. I wished things had worked out differently. I wished I could have given her what she wanted and that she had not left me for some other man. I wished the people in charge on Terrano had listened to me and the girls in Ava's orphanage had not been incinerated. Wishes were like intentions. They counted for shit.
We're meeting the Cygnus Central Fleet at Providence Cree. I'm going to leave you there for a little while.
How long of a little while?
I don't know. You'll be a lot safer there than you would be on a ship. The Unifieds aren't attacking planets.
The aliens are.
You'll be safer on a planet than you would be on a ship. At least you will be for a little while.
You live for this. You live to fight, don't you?
The Unifieds haven't asked for a truce. The aliens are still scorching planets.
I hoped maybe Terrano was the end of it.
The aliens are going to attack every planet we have until they erase us from the galaxy. War with the Unified is just a distraction. They're like two kids fighting over a toy while their house burns down around them.
Ava put up a hand to stop me. She did not want to talk about aliens or reality. Hearing me mention the Avatari ended the charade. She stood there, her eyes twitching back and forth as if she were having some sort of seizure. Her arms dropped to her sides, and her hands formed fists.
They kill everyone. They killed my girls. My girls had their whole lives ahead of them. How long do we have before the Avatari reach Providence Cree?
I don't know. I think it will be one of the last planets they hit before they attack Earth.
Earth?
While Ava and I discussed life, the galaxy, and the Avatari, Captain Cutter sailed the Churchill into a 1,000-mile-wide zone flooded with highly charged electrical current from the local broadcast station. As the ship entered that zone, great tendrils of voltage formed around her hull, creating a glow so bright it could leave a man blinded. The streaks of electricity running the length of the ship carried so many joules that they would incinerate the entire crew had the ship not been properly insulated. A flash of electricity so bright it could be detected by the human eye from a million miles away marked the ship's exit from one arm of the galaxy, and an equally bright flash marked its entrance into the next. That flash was called an anomaly. Every broadcast was a scientific miracle, but pan-galactic travel had become so mundane that the crew of the Churchill did not even think about it. Location: Planet A361D. Galactic position: Solar System A361. Astronomic location: Bodas Galaxy. Because of their synchronous orbits around A361D, the two moons always remained on opposite sides of the planet. The sun shone on the far side of the planet, its glow illuminating the back of the planet and both of its moons. The sides facing the fleet were bathed in shadow. Three of the Japanese fleet's four battleships had flown into position 100,000 miles from the moons. The Yamato and the Yonoda hovered nearer to A361D Satellite 1, the larger of the two moons, the one with the flat plain that looked like a landing field. The Kyoto patrolled A361D Satellite 2, the smaller moon. The Sakura remained another 100,000 miles back, far enough away for Admiral Yamashiro to watch both moons from a viewport. He sat on the observation deck with Captain Takahashi.
How do you think they will react when we destroy their moons?
They would have attacked us already if they had the ability. They must not have a navy. It's as if they spent so much time conquering other planets that they have forgotten how to defend their own.
Takahashi walked to the viewport and leaned against the rail that ran beneath the glass. He stared out at A361D. The gas giant was a muddle of yellow and brown and orange. Far in the background, A361,
The star from which the solar system took its name burned like an electrified ember.
What will we do if they shoot back at us?
We've analyzed the moons. They pose no threat.
The video feed from one of the satellites shadowed the Onoda. Another showed a view of seemingly empty space that was in fact occupied by a stealth transport. That same satellite also had a telescopic sight on the moon, which included a very clear view of the flat area that Yamashiro's officers now called the deck. Everyone agreed that it looked like a landing field, but it could also have been the roof of a huge subterranean city or a missile defense system. Because he did not know what lurked under that flat top, Yamashiro had sent the Yamato to back up the Onoda. On his computer screen, a satellite tracked the Yamato as it approached the larger moon, lagging 20,000 miles behind her sister ship. Yamashiro didn't care about the moon or what it housed. Gathering scientific data did not interest him. Back in his office, Yamashiro had a photograph that he had not yet shared with Takahashi or the other captains, one that made the deck on A361D Satellite 1 and the little ring of buildings on A361D Satellite 2 look insignificant. It was a photographic image of planet A361B taken by a scout satellite, and it showed a city. The two lead transports carried infiltration pods, but no seals to fly them. On this mission, they would use the SIPs as weapons instead of transports. On this mission, the SIPs were both the message and the messenger. Two technicians rode in the kettle of each of the transports. The technicians did not need to open the pods to program them. They prepared the pods using special computer stations. Now that the pods would be used as torpedoes, the techs loaded the SIPs into the launching device with new reverence. Admiral Yamashiro ordered the attack, and Miyamoto Genyo, captain of the Onoda, coordinated it. Sitting on the bridge of his battleship, grim-faced, his eyes dark as flints, his lips pressed so tightly together they formed a single flesh-colored line, his shoulders tight, Genyo watched the satellite feeds, ready to pull the plug on the operation if something went wrong.
Charge the infiltration pods!
Time seemed to freeze at that moment. For Miyamoto, who had never put much thought into the length of 2 minutes, the next 147 seconds felt like a lifetime. From the bridge of his ship, he watched the larger moon, studying the curve of its surface, and he wondered what mysteries it held. Miyamoto looked at the timer and saw that only 20 seconds had passed. Miyamoto watched an unenhanced view of the moon through a viewport. Seen from hundreds of thousands of miles away, its surface had no more features than a rubber ball. 27 seconds had passed. Miyamoto turned to his satellite feeds, his expression unflinching. Through the satellite's mobile eye, he could count the pea-sized pebbles around the target. He could see the deck and the land around it. The satellite allowed him to zoom in close enough to study a grain of sand or pan his view out so far he could peer down an entire hemisphere. The timer showed that 1 minute and 5 seconds had passed.
Pilots, purge air from the kettles and open the rear hatches.
The pilots responded immediately. This was the pivotal moment. By opening their hatches, the transports would nullify the stealth envelope that kept them hidden. If the aliens were watching, they would detect the transports and they might attack. Seconds ticked by slowly. 1 minute and 5 seconds became 1:15, and then 1:35.
Prepare to launch!
1 minute and 52 seconds, 53, 54, 55. Miyamoto clenched his hands into fists and hid his fists by his sides so that no one saw him trembling. He felt the weight of humanity upon him, but his eyes remained fixed.
Fire!
Captain Takahashi, standing by the viewport and watching the larger of the moons, only knew that the mission had begun because Yamashiro told him. There were no explosions or bursts of laser to signal the beginning of the attack. He was still staring out into space, waiting to see what would happen to the moons. He turned in time to see Yamashiro yelling into the communications console.
Return to the Sakura! Return immediately! There are no survivors!
Takahashi wanted to know what had happened, but he knew better than to interrupt the Admiral. Still listening for clues, he looked out through the viewport and searched in time to see the smaller of the moons fall apart. First, it blurred into a smudge, as if fog had formed on the viewport. An envelope of fog or dust or maybe gas formed around it. Whatever rose off A361D Satellite 2, it was the same color as the moon itself and translucent. It did not spread. It remained tight around the moon and became thicker and thicker, a stifling, suffocating cloud. Focusing on the words, "No survivors," Takahashi wondered if somehow one of the transports had collided with the moon. But Satellite 2 had come undone, and that suggested more than a transport mishap. The core that held the moon together broke and dissolved before his eyes. Feeling a sense of elation, Takahashi looked at the larger moon, hoping to see similar destruction. Nothing had changed on Satellite 1.
No! Do not return to the Sakura!
Takahashi heard something in Yamashiro's voice he had never heard before. He heard fear.
Rendezvous with the other transport, but do not return to this ship until you are given further orders.
Yamashiro switched channels to relay orders to the bridge.
Prepare to broadcast.
Admiral, are you leaving us in space?
Takahashi knew the man was a transport pilot.
We will return for you. We are broadcasting out of the solar system. We will contact you in...
Yamashiro clearly did not know how to finish the sentence.
Yes, sir.
Yamashiro turned his attention to the bridge.
Broadcast status. What is our broadcast status? We need to broadcast now.
Admiral, the generator is not yet charged.
Yamashiro stared at the screens, glanced toward the viewport, looking right through Takahashi, then back at the screens.
Broadcast us. The moon is ready.
What is our destination, sir?
Out of the solar system. Anywhere outside of the solar system.
Admiral, where do you want us to rendezvous?
Get as far from A361D as you can. As far from every planet as you can. Get as far as you can from these planets and keep flying farther away. We find you. When we return, we find you.
Takahashi stood behind Admiral Yamashiro, staring over his shoulder. He looked into the various screens and saw nothing. All but one of the displays showed nothing but open space.
Why are we broadcasting out of the solar system?
If Yamashiro heard the question, he did not acknowledge it. He sat hunched over the monitors, as if searching for secrets in the empty screens.
Admiral, why are we leaving the solar system?
Yamashiro still showed no sign of hearing him.
Admiral, the engines are...
Take us out of the solar system!
What is our destination, sir?
Out! Out anywhere out of the system!
What about the other ships?
No!
Tent shields formed on the viewport, blocking any hint of the one remaining moon. A moment later, the Sakura had broadcasted out of solar system A361.
How will we find the other ships?
Slowly turning in his chair so that he faced his son-in-law, his dark eyes burning with more intensity than Takahashi had ever seen in them, Yamashiro looked crazed.
They have been destroyed.
The video feeds were clear and mysterious. The feed of A361D Satellite 1 showed a bird's-eye view of the deck and the surface of the moon. For a tenth of a second, maybe only a hundredth of a second, light flared across the screen. A small wisp of steam formed and dissipated. Steam and smoke vanished quickly in the absolute zero temperature and vacuum conditions of space. Slowing the feed to 5 seconds per frame did not make a difference. Whatever happened, it happened so quickly that the camera on the satellite could not record it. One moment there was open space, then light appeared and vanished, then the steam appeared and dissolved. Yamashiro played that portion of the video 3 times without saying a word.
What was that?
That was the destruction of an infiltration pod.
Yamashiro ran the loop again, this time even more slowly. The 1 second feed lasted nearly 10 minutes.
That can't be a pod.
Yamashiro switched to a screen that showed a battleship. One moment she lingered peaceably in space. Something happened. Like the SIP, the big ship did not explode. She left no debris. It was like a magician's illusion. For just a moment, the battleship seemed to inflate. Then she crumpled, folding in on herself, compressing until nothing remained except a formless wad of space-colored junk leaking tendrils of steam or smoke.
The Onoda.
That cannot be.
I can show you what happened to the Kyoto and the Yamato. They vanished the same way.
We need to go back. We need to help them. We need to look for survivors.
We need to accomplish our mission. They sent us here because we are expendable. We are not a part of the Unified Authority. We are the Japanese. Our fleet and our men were the price we paid to return to Earth.
Takahashi looked at the screen again and re-witnessed the destruction of the Onoda. It was as if the ship had melted. Earth date, November 21, AD 2517. Location, Providence Cree. Galactic position, Cygnus R. Astronomic location, Milky Way. More often than not, the Unified Authority colonized planets that came complete with continents and an oxygenated atmosphere. The Galactic Expansion Committee's top criteria for selecting suitable locales included distance from a suitable and stable star, Earth-like size and gravity, and good galactic position. Since the prime criteria could not be altered, they were non-negotiable. Other preferences, such as oxygen and water, were open to interpretation. Providence Cree, for instance, was something of a fixer-upper when the Unified Authority decided to colonize it. The term Cree was attached to planets that required terraforming, a miracle process that could convert rocks and deserts into gardens of Eden. As I entered the bridge, I saw Providence Cree in its rotation through the viewscreen. Whatever the planet had looked like before the Unified Authority gave it a makeover, it certainly looked like a hospitable blue and green marble afterward. Looking out of a viewport, I wondered how long we had until the Avatari turned this planet into a dust bowl as well. Leota and an entourage of fleet officers flew out to the Churchill to meet me. We did not have time to chat. Time had become scarce.
I have a pilot delivering keys and coordinate cards to every fleet. He'll have a key to Jolly within the hour.
So we're back in business.
Leota glanced at the list of broadcast coordinates. Then he paused.
New Copenhagen? I thought they destroyed that planet.
They did?
Why would we want to go there?
That's the point. There's absolutely no reason to go there. If there's no good reason to go there, the Unifieds probably aren't patrolling the area.
So it's a safe place to regroup?
Something like that.
I did not say goodbye to Ava. As I said before, time was scarce. She would be safe on Providence Cree until we evacuated the planet. Once the evacuation was done and the danger had passed, we would sit down and sort things out, assuming she had any interest in sorting things out with me. I had not come to Providence Cree to drop off refugees or meet with officers, though I did a little of both. I had come to commandeer a new ship. With her shields broken, the Churchill needed repairs or retirement, so Freeman and I transferred to a carrier named the Bolivar. I met the captain on the bridge, handed him a broadcast key, and told him to take us to New Copenhagen. Captain Tom McKay heard my orders.
I heard the aliens scorched that planet.
They did?
I just wanted to make sure.
Shortly after the Bolivar broadcasted into the Orion arm, Freeman and I met in a small conference room off the bridge. He brought the computer, I brought the codes, and we put in another call to the late Dr. Sweetwater. This time, more than one ghost answered the call. Arthur Breeze stared at me from the little oblong screen of the communications computer.
When William told me about your call, I couldn't believe it. You said you were on Terrano when the Avatari attacked.
Something like that.
We understand Terrano was a total loss.
We'd already told Sweetwater the gory details. Apparently, he wanted us to rehash them for Breeze's benefit.
Did you arrive too late to evacuate the planet?
We didn't have the barges, and Dropov had no interest in evacuating Terrano.
Why would the government leave them to die?
The local leadership declared independence when we liberated the planet. Terrano wasn't part of the Unified Authority.
What did you think you could accomplish going alone?
I tried to get the government to send everyone underground.
Terrano had a sizable population. Were there facilities for that many people?
I don't know. I didn't think it through.
So counting Olympus Cree and Terrano, we've managed to liberate 24 planets so far? Is that correct?
24 planets including Terrano, that's right.
Did any other planets wish to remain independent?
Didn't I hear something about Gobi demanding independence?
Gobi?
Gobi broke from the Republic? That might explain their attitude toward the planet.
Whose attitude?
Mr. Andropov's, General Hill's, the Joint Chiefs. We held a briefing with them a day ago. When I told them that the aliens would attack Gobi by the end of the week, they didn't seem to care.
The end of the week?
It'll happen within the next 3 days, judging by the Tachyon D levels.
Tachyon D was the harbinger of disaster. From what we could tell, the Avatari built their technology around the manipulation of tachyons, subatomic particles that moved faster than the speed of light. Before the Avatari invaded the galaxy, scientists considered tachyons a theoretical probability. Once the aliens moved in on us, tachyons moved from theoretical possibility to lethal reality. With Sweetwater and Breeze spearheading the work, UA physicists not only learned how to detect tachyons, but apparently they'd now figured out how to classify them.
To be honest, the Joint Chiefs haven't shown much interest in any planet since we discovered tachyon D levels in Earth's atmosphere.
You found tachyon D in Earth's atmosphere?
We've found traces of it on every habitable planet. The gears are definitely in motion.
We were out of options. We were out of answers. And we were still at war with ourselves. I had given Admiral Steve Jolly command of the Navy, but I kept Sweetwater and Breeze to myself. I did not have much of a choice in the matter. Freeman owned our only portal for reaching the scientists, and he wasn't about to turn the device over to a fool like Jolly. Leaving out the source of my information, I notified Admiral Jolly about the pending attack on Gobi. I spoke to him over a communications console.
How did you come upon this information?
Jolly was on the Windsor, a fighter carrier in the Perseus arm.
Stray intel.
Stray intelligence?
Yes, sir.
What exactly does that mean, Harris?
It means that I'm not willing to divulge my source.
Your stray intelligence just happens to match my findings. It turns out Gobi was the first planet we took after Terrano. From what we know, that should make it the aliens' next target.
Yes, sir.
You said something about hiding underground on Terrano. Can we do that on Gobi?
Have you ever visited Gobi, Admiral?
Yes. And you were there at the same time. I attended Warshaw's summit with Admiral Huxley.
I had not known the late Admiral Huxley. He was one of the victims of the Olympus Cree massacre.
I hid in a tunnel under a lake on Terrano. As far as I know, Gobi doesn't have tunnels or lakes.
If I am not mistaken, Gobi Station has underground levels. What if we evacuated people to the base?
We might be able to stash a few hundred people there, but I'm not sure we'd be able to get them out after the attack. Gobi Station is made out of plastic and metal. It's going to melt when things get hot.
Melt?
The atmospheres of Terrano and Olympus Cree hit 9,000 degrees. Everything made out of glass, steel, or plastic ended up in a puddle.
9,000 degrees? That doesn't sound possible. 9,000 degrees? How do you heat a planet to 9,000 degrees?
If we knew how the bastards did it, we'd do it to them.
How are we supposed to evacuate an entire planet?
Gobi's only the first. We'll need to evacuate all of our planets. At least we're starting light. The population of Gobi is less than 1 million.
Do you know how many ships we'd need to transport 1 million civilians?
4.
You're planning on stealing the Unified's barges.
The word stealing has a negative connotation. Let's just say I plan on commandeering the barges. We'll give them back once the emergency passes.
Well, do you even know where the barges are moored?
Last I heard, they were orbiting Mars.
Well, it sounds like you have it all worked out, General. Is that just bluster? Or do you really believe you can hijack those barges?
Oh, I'll get them. The Unifieds aren't going to shoot at us once we board the barges. They need those scows as much as we do.
Then what?
Then what what?
If I understand what you are saying, you and a small team of operatives plan to sneak behind enemy lines and board 25 ships that are not self-broadcasting and have no defenses. Your only protection is that the Unifieds probably won't risk shooting at the ships, which are still trapped in Unified Authority space. General, you haven't thought this through.
The Unifieds have a temporary broadcast station orbiting Mars. They used it to broadcast the barges to Olympus Cree.
Are you sure it's still there?
Yes.
And you believe it's still operational?
Yes, sir.
And you can access it. Please tell me that you are not simply planning to sail into a broadcast station without knowing where it will send you.
I have engineers who can hack into the satellite's computers.
Assuming you are able to locate the barges, and assuming you are able to spirit them away to Gobi, what are you planning to do with the refugees you rescue?
Evacuate them.
And where are you going to put them?
Oh. Well, I hadn't thought about that.
We have facilities on Providence Cree. There's empty housing.
Hell, we have entire cities that are sitting empty.
Yes, we can ferry them to Providence Cree. After talking to Jolly, I contacted Lieutenant Mars in engineering.
There has got to be a way to run this mission without the spy cruiser. You blew the ship to Swiss cheese a couple of days ago.
You blew the ship to Swiss cheese. You were the one who rigged the cannons.
Fine, I blew the ship to Swiss cheese following your orders. It's still Swiss cheese.
We need it, Lieutenant.
General, I'm a believing man. I believe that Peter walked on water. I believe Moses crossed the Red Sea on dry land. I even believe Jesus fed thousands of people with a few loaves of bread and a half a dozen fishes. God performed those miracles. If you want your ship resurrected in 3 days, maybe you should go to him.
If ever I need a sea split, I'll ask him for help. In the meantime, I need you to repair the spy ship.
You do understand that the loaves, the fishes, the water into wine, the resurrections, Christ performed those miracles, not his disciples?
Give it your best shot.
We can't even fly her into dry dock. She's too banged up. One of her engines came off.
I need that spy ship, that very ship, engines and stealth generator running by the end of the day.
General, sir, may I remind you that you waited until the ship lowered her shields before you fired on her?
Sounds like you have your work cut out for you.
You do understand, sir, that the damage was not just to the hull. I toured that wreck. You blew the holy snot out of it. General, a stealth generator is a sophisticated piece of equipment. I couldn't make one if I had the cookbook and all the ingredients. If you handed me all the parts and the instructions and gave me a year to put it together, I would not be able to do it.
Well, good thing you only need to repair this one.
From what I hear, repairing them is more difficult than building them, sir. It's not like they carried spare parts on the ship. If that generator is damaged, it's going to need replacement boards. We can't just make them, sir. It's not as easy as reloading a rifle. And then there's the broadcast engine. If the broadcast chain is damaged, I mean, General, the Corps of Engineers builds dams and electrical grids. You're talking about one of the most sophisticated...
Lieutenant, we're wasting time.
No, sir. I am not wasting your time. I am trying to save time. I don't want to waste time trying to fix a ship that I can't possibly fix.
The aliens are about to attack Gobi. If we don't evacuate that planet, every man, woman, and child on Gobi is going to burn. They're going to burn just like the people on Terrano burned. I can't evacuate Gobi unless I steal the Unified's barges. And in order to steal them, I need a working spy ship. I need that cruiser, stealth generator, broadcast engines, and all. Do you understand me? You have your orders, Lieutenant.
Yes, sir.
While Mars worked miracles, I assembled guns and men and ships. I hoped we would find the barges moored near the Mars spaceport, sitting empty and completely ignored. More likely, we would find them guarded by a skeleton crew, security men who would slow us down at a time when every second wasted would cost lives. I studied a large holographic map of Mars, the planet, not the engineer. The map showed the planet with a blacked-out area representing the spaceport and the military base. Until we ran some sort of reconnaissance mission, we would not know the precise location of the barges or what kind of force guarded them. When I explained my plan to the three admirals through the holographic meeting device, Jolly shook his head.
Risky tactics, General. Launching a mission with no idea what you might be up against.
Admiral Wallace, sarcastically referred to as Warhawk Wallace on the bridge of the Bolivar, took my side.
You know, Admiral, they may damn well let Harris have the barges. We need them to rescue natural-borns.
Natural-borns who are loyal to the enlisted man's empire.
True, but natural-borns nonetheless. It's a specking humanitarian effort.
Good point, Pete. Why don't we just ring up Andropov and ask if we can borrow his barges?
I checked the specking orbits. Mars and Earth are approximately 80 million miles apart. Even with their fastest ships, the Unifieds will take 3 specking hours to respond.
They have self-broadcasting ships, Admiral. They'll need 8 minutes to charge their broadcast engines. If we're not out of there after 8 minutes, the shooting starts.
General, can you give me a ballpark on how much time you'll need to pull this off?
I'm thinking 7 minutes and 59 seconds.
Now how the spec did you come up with that?
Isn't it obvious? That's 1 second less than it takes the Unifieds to charge their broadcast engines.
The Unifieds won't be expecting us. That should buy us a little time. If we broadcast in here,
I pointed at the side of Mars that pointed away from Earth.
We can use the planet to hide our anomaly from Earth. Assuming no one is out sightseeing on the far side of Mars, we should go unnoticed. If everything goes right and they don't spot the anomaly, we should be able to approach the barges without being seen.
They'll pick up your cruiser when you launch your transports. You can't launch without lowering your shields, and the transports won't be cloaked.
Yeah, but by then it should be too late. If we maneuver the spy ship in close enough, we should have crews aboard every barge in 3 minutes.
As long as the Unifieds did not catch us broadcasting in, we'd be able to slide right up to the barges.
General, even if you reach the barges, how will you get them out without a broadcast station?
Our broadcast network extended only to the planets we controlled. It was the remnant of the old Unified Authority broadcast network, the pan-galactic superhighway that had once linked Earth to all of its 180 colonies. Back in those days, the satellite broadcast station orbiting Mars was the linchpin of the network. The Mogats destroyed it during the Civil War, cutting Earth off from its colonies.
The Unifieds launched a temporary broadcast station for evacuation. That was how they got the barges to Olympus Cree.
And you think they will let you use it to steal their barges, do you?
I think we can commandeer it along with the barges.
Oh, you'll just hack into their security system, no problem.
Something like that. Look, Admiral, the Unifieds aren't expecting us to enter their space. They're not going to have extensive security guarding that satellite.
You're basing your plans on a lot of guesswork.
Educated guesses.
I'm not inclined to authorize this operation.
Really?
You're taking an unreasonable risk.
Admiral, doing nothing would be an unreasonable risk. The aliens are going to attack Gobi in 2 days. How many people do you expect to evacuate without the barges?
That's not the point, General. Civilian casualties are not our only concern. Once you launch your transports, how long will it take you to board the barges?
We just went over this, Admiral. I told you it should take no more than 3 minutes to place teams aboard all 25 barges.
3 minutes? That seems very optimistic.
It's a realistic estimate, sir. Remember, the clock doesn't start counting down until we start launching transports. Until then, the Unifieds won't know we are there. That means we can pull the spy ship right up to their docks.
I could not tell if Wallace and Leota agreed with him or realized he was a coward. Maybe they'd known he was a coward from the start. Whatever their reasons, they had become silent.
3 minutes? Is that really possible?
Absolutely, sir. If we catch the Unifieds napping, the entire mission will be over in 8 minutes. We'll be done before their ships arrive on the scene.
Well, this is all moot, unless your engineers get that stealth cruiser going.
Absolutely, Admiral. I wouldn't dream of running the mission without a working spy ship.
Mars got the spy ship running. While his men began work on the hull and the engines, he sent a message across all 13 fleets looking for engineers with stealth generator experience. 3 men responded. Before Congress had banished us clones to space, they had worked as technicians in the lab that developed the stealth engines. We were in business. Walking through the corridors of the cruiser, I could see that the ship was still a wreck. Not having enough time to replace the ruined sections of the hull, Mars' engineers had patched the holes as best they could. They ignored fixes deemed non-essential to the operation of the ship. As I entered the second deck, I noticed that the lights were out.
You going to fix those?
The surveillance and recon computers were on this deck. The engineers Mars had sent to hack into the broadcast station would work on this deck as well.
God be praised, they'll be wearing soft-shelled armor, sir.
Yeah, so?
Well, this might be an excellent opportunity for them to acquaint themselves with the lighting array along their visors.
What if they decide to remove their helmets?
I would recommend against that, sir. We haven't repaired the oxygen generator.
Well, that could be a problem. What if someone needs to use the head?
Probably not a good idea, General. We haven't restored power to the toilets either. You wanted a self-broadcasting spy ship with working stealth engines, sir? Not a luxury cruiser. Getting the broadcast and stealth gear running was miracle enough.
Realizing that the only things holding the ship together were chewing gum and Scott Mars's faith in God, I decided to cut the inspection short.
I returned to the bridge as Don Cutter prepared for the inaugural broadcast. With the Churchill out of commission, he had nothing better to do than risk his life helping me.
Feeling lucky?
He and his three-man bridge crew wore the soft armor used by technicians and engineers.
Mars says the ship is fine. With all due respect, sir, that's bullshit. The engines work and the holes are plugged, but this ship is several miles south of fine.
Just get us out there.
Yes, sir. You should probably use the tint shields in your visor, sir.
The tint shields in my visor normally came on automatically, but a quick glimpse of the glare from the anomaly could do a great deal of damage if you looked into it before your shields kicked in. Using optical commands, I initiated the shields. The only problem was that in the moments before the broadcast, the shields left me blind. Then the broadcast began. Even through the blackness of my tint shields, I could see the anomaly, its thick tendrils of electricity wrapping like ivy around the hull of the ship. I should have looked away from the viewport, but I was mesmerized. To me, the anomaly was like a passageway to death, and death fascinated me. And then I saw nothing. We had completed the broadcast and left the anomaly to fade behind us. I deactivated the tint shields, and there was Mars, the planet, a tawny-colored globe in a solitary orbit. Our stealth generator running, we circled Mars. The planet was dark and still below us. It only took a minute to locate the barges. They sat unguarded and alone. Everything had gone according to plan so far. I entered Landing Bay 1, which was dark as death and silent. The night for day lenses in my visor lit the scene well enough. The landing bay floor was enormous and packed tight with 7 transports. Parked with their rear hatches open, the heavy birds sat so close together that their stubby wings interlocked like a cog. The men in my company had already boarded the transports. I expected to find them swarming the deck like ants at a picnic. But there was no room on the deck, so they huddled in the kettles, readying for war. The spy ship was still a few minutes from the barges, but closing in quickly when I entered the lead transport. The sailor coordinating the mission gave the signal, and our pilot sealed the rear hatch and prepared to launch. A sled towed the transport through the flight tube, past disabled atmospheric locks. We did not launch when we reached the end of the runway. Our transports weren't cloaked. Once they launched, the Unifieds would spot them and the countdown would begin. Instead of leaving our transports lined up on the deck, flight control lined us up in the tube. As each bird left the ship, the next one would follow on her tail. Along with a company of Marines, our transport carried a team of 3 sailors. Once we secured the barge, it would fall upon these men to pilot her out. As I waited in the kettle, a Marine approached me and saluted.
General Harris, sir, the other transports are in place.
My visor read his identity from a chip in his visor and labeled him Major Hunter Ritz.
Ritz? Didn't you serve on Terrano?
Yes, sir. From the beginning, sir. I went down with you and Hollingsworth when you liberated the planet.
And now you're a company commander.
Yes, sir.
I was glad to have a battle-tested Marine in my ranks, a man who would not lose control if things headed south.
I'm going up to the cockpit.
Aye, sir.
The sea of men parted for me as I crossed the kettle. I climbed the ladder, walked the tight catwalk, and entered the cockpit. My pilot was Lieutenant Christian Nobles, the Marine I had adopted as my private pilot. He wore combat armor. Once all the transports were docked, he would join in the fight. I sat in the co-pilot's chair.
Once more into the breach.
I saved your seat for you, sir, but I wasn't sure you were coming. I thought maybe you'd forgotten about me.
Some pilots sit as still as statues while they wait to take off. Lieutenant Nobles was a tinkerer. I tried to ignore him as he pulled out his M27.
When was the last time you stripped and oiled your piece?
Yesterday, sir.
Can you think of any reason why you would have botched the job?
No, sir.
Is there any reason why anyone would have specked with your weapon?
No, sir.
Have you dropped it in mud since you stripped it?
No, sir.
Were you drunk when you assembled it?
No, sir.
Then leave it alone.
Aye, sir. Yes, sir.
I received a message over my command link.
General, we are almost in place, sir. 50 miles and closing.
The outer hatch slid open, revealing a galaxy of stars and darkness. With a tap of our thrusters, Noble lifted the transport off the sled, and we glided into space. By this time, we had circled Mars and come around to the side facing the sun. A dust-colored planet glowed below us, and I saw Mars' spaceport, a white and gray plateau that looked too large to be man-made. It formed a plane across a small corner of the planet's surface. And above the spaceport, moored in five razor-straight rows, were the barges we had come to collect. They did not look like ships. They looked like floating boxes.
Listen up. This is General Wason Harris. I am personally overseeing this operation. You've all been briefed. You know your objectives. You know your assignments. Shoot anyone who gets in your way on this op. With all of the planets we need to evacuate, every one of these barges is worth millions of lives. We can't afford to lose a single barge. We don't have time for mistakes or mercy on this one.
It might have been that no one was guarding the barges, or it might have been that we caught them napping. The big ships remained stationary, silent, and dark as we sidled up beside them. The barge did not have landing bays. It was designed for quick evacuations, and the slow act of towing transports in and out through launch tubes and atmospheric locks did not fit the mode. The hulls of the barges were dotted with landing pads, hard points with magnetic clamps and retractable entryways. These ships did not have weapons or shields. They were leviathans, giant whales traveling the galaxy, defenseless against attack. Our transports touched down on the landing pads, and the entryways automatically extended. They attached to the rear hatches of our transports, creating a seal. Time was of the essence. I left the cockpit and went into the belly of the transport. My heart pounding hard and steady, my combat reflex already begun, I stood at the front of my company like a private on point duty, my finger already over the trigger of my gun, as I watched the doors of the transport slowly grind open. Since the barge had hundreds of landing pads along its hull, there was no way a skeleton security control could have guarded every entrance, so it was no surprise when the hatch opened to an empty tube. We charged down the entryway, two platoons, each with its own commanding and executive officers. I led the way. The entryway was a hall wide enough for 10 men walking side by side. Though I had seen the barges during the evacuation of Olympus Cree, I had never set foot on one. The grand size of it took me aback. Maybe it would look smaller, crowded with people, but seeing the long, empty deck overwhelmed my senses. Dozens of spiraling stairwells twisted up from the floor like giant corkscrews. There was no furniture. Since I had assigned myself to point position, Major Ritz expected me to report.
General, do you see anyone?
Either they're hiding in the heads, or this deck is secure.
Aye, sir. I'll send a couple of men to flush out the head.
You do that. We don't want anyone sneaking out from behind the toilets.
Aye, sir.
Tell your men to stay alert. If there's anybody on this bird, they're going to hit us as we go up the stairs. That's how I would do it. The stairs or the cockpit.
Stairs and cockpit. Aye, sir.
A couple of men split off to check the toilets. The rest of us started toward the stairs. Ritz divided his men into platoons. Then he broke the platoons into squads, allowing him to cover 8 sets of stairs at one time. The spiral stairwells were a natural bottleneck. Even worse, they were a bottleneck with a blind spot. Anyone climbing the stairs would be defenseless as he passed through the ceiling and entered the floor above. The stairs were wide enough for 3 men to climb at a time, but we stuck to procedure, offering up a point man, who peered from the top of the stairs into the next deck, as vulnerable as a gopher climbing out of its hole. We sent men up 8 flights of stairs, and every single one came rolling back down with blood leaking from large holes in his helmet.
Pull back!
I sprinted aft, away from the action. As wide as the barge was, built to carry 10,000 passengers on each of its 25 decks, there were hundreds of sets of stairs. They'd need an entire battalion to cover every set of stairs on a bird this big. I sprinted a couple of hundred yards to reach the far side of the deck and climbed the last set of stairs. I crept up and paused just below the ceiling, my finger on the trigger of my M27. I peered up from the top of the stairs and saw a wide open floor. I spotted the unfriendlies, but they were a long way away and very distracted at the moment. They did not notice as I continued up the stairs to the next deck.
Do you read me?
General?
Got any flash grenades?
I crept across the empty deck. I lay on the floor and stared down a stairwell at the attackers. They were not dressed in armor. I got the feeling they were maintenance, deck sweepers and latrine wipers, but I could not get a count of their numbers.
Yes, sir.
Lob a couple up the stairs, then give me a few seconds to clear out the debris.
Are you up there?
Borrowing a tactic from Freeman, I answered the question by ignoring it.
Make sure your grenadiers know which pills to throw. We can't afford to damage the ship.
Yes, sir.
And Ritz, make sure your men don't shoot me when they come up the stairs. I'm the only one wearing combat armor.
Aye, sir.
I activated the tint shields to protect my eyes as I lay still and waited.
I only saw a trace of the flash through the tent tube. The glare evaporated quickly, and I switched back to tactical vision as I leaped down the stairs and engaged. Ritz's men secured the ship quickly, and we rushed our pilots to the cockpit. We did not bother checking the engine for booby traps. The Unifieds would not do anything to endanger the barges. They couldn't. In a few short weeks, they would need the birds as much as we did. The other barges were commandeered without taking casualties. We were the only team that encountered resistance. I entered the cockpit and overheard our pilot.
What the hell do you mean they're offline? No one shuts their reactors down.
It's not the reactors. We can't engage the engines.
Why would they take their engines offline?
Maybe it's a security measure.
The pilot turned to me.
We've got a problem, sir. The engines aren't responding.
I wanted to ask the bastard what he expected me to do about it, but I kept my mouth shut.
There must be a security code. See if you can override it.
How the spec am I supposed to do that?
Find the docking computer and disengage it.
If this specker has a docking computer, it's gonna be in a cockpit.
The pilot played with his computer.
Speck in hell. I found it. Disengaging docking buoys.
The barge hummed to life. Then we pulled away from the buoy. And the barge went completely dark. There wasn't any warning. One moment we were moving, and the next moment the lights went out and the power shut off.
What speck just happened?
I stepped to the window of the cockpit and looked out at the row of darkened ships beside us. Off in the distance, five anomalies appeared like small explosions. The Unifieds had broadcasted ships in to intercept us. They were tens of thousands of miles away. But the term, thousands of miles, loses its meaning when discussing ships capable of traveling 39 million miles in an hour. Using the command link in my visor, I contacted the mission coordinator.
We have a serious problem here. Have your engineers hacked into the broadcast station?
That was the beauty of having a spy ship in your fleet. Somewhere out there, a team of engineers sat on an invisible cruiser as they broke into Unified Authority transportation computers.
The Unifieds must have remote access to our controls.
I am aware of the situation.
Are you also aware that half the damned UA Navy just broadcasted in to stop us?
They won't attack, General. The Unifieds need those barges.
They have us cornered.
I have the situation under control.
Outside our barge, the Unified Authority continued to close in on us. Our barges sat defenseless. We sat defenseless. They would not attack us with their cannons and fighters, but we weren't going anywhere with our engines down and our power off.
You better do something.
Not yet.
What the spec are you waiting for?
General, you do realize that the Unifieds may be listening in on our conversation.
The Unifieds had sent five ships to stop us. Five capital ships. I could see them clearly. I could see the sharp tips of their bows and the flares from their engines. Only a few miles away, they drifted toward us, circling in for the kill. One of the ships lowered its shields, and a line of transports drifted out from each of its landing bays. The same lack of precautions that had enabled us to enter this barge would now work against us. In another 5 minutes, those transports would attach themselves to our barge.
Engage tent shields.
I obeyed, but I did not understand.
Shit.
Behind the battleships, the Mars broadcast station flared into overdrive, its power glowing as bright as a star. It was closer to the Unified ships than I had imagined, and moving in fast, with threads of lightning flashing across its dish. I did not know how they accomplished it, but somehow our hackers had freed the station from its orbit and sent it flying in our direction. In another moment, its anomaly would destroy the Unified Authority's self-broadcasting ships. Ships with built-in broadcast engines need to avoid broadcast stations because exposure to an externally generated anomaly overloads their broadcast generators. The anomaly destroyed the UA transports as well. And then the juice from the broadcast station engulfed the barges. I saw the lightning through my tent shields, jagged, dancing slabs of white fire that wrapped around the cockpit. When I lowered my tent shields and looked out into space, we were orbiting Gobi.
Did we get any of their ships?
Admiral Jolly answered.
We got all of them, General. We destroyed two self-broadcasting destroyers and three self-broadcasting battleships. I don't know how many battleships they have left, but I'll bet they don't have any to spare.
Nope. Sooner or later, they're going to run out of ships.